Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos. Hello, this is the second part of two featuring Steve Lowe from L13. If you've not yet listened to part one, stop where you are, go back and listen. It's an absolute belter. In this half, Steve tells us what Harry Adams, Billy Childish, Jimmy Cauty and Jamie Reid have got in store this year, what L13 have got going on as we speak, and even what's about to happen in Japan. And if you can't remember where we were at the end of the last episode, Steve was just talking about parental praise or how the lack or want of it can affect an individual throughout their life. So here's part two.
So it has made me try very hard. But, you know, like I said, I was more into, you know, rebelling and doing things that I didn't need approval for. And it's something that I'm very aware that Billy had a very kind of difficult childhood. Yeah. And again, his brother was always trying to seek approval of his dad, and Billy had decided that he wasn't going to try and do that. And I think there is something about self-acknowledgement. You know, it's like, I'm doing what I want to do in the way that I want to do it, and that is my aim. I'm not too interested
and
in...
And that is breaking the shackles, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and I'm not into... it's nice when people... When I get a pat on the head, you know, but I don't need it. You know, it's I'm not hungry for that. Yeah. I'm hungry for doing what I think I should be doing and doing it in the way that I think it should be done.
Perfect. And so that's how I see L13. Is that what you just said there?
Yeah. And that comes to even, you know, the way that we do things is... And actually, this happened when we were in a band as well. It was like we always recorded our set. We started off by, it's partly because we couldn't afford to go into a recording studio, so we just hired in recording equipment and worked out how to do it ourselves. And I think I'm a little bit of a control freak. So when we started publishing prints and books, I found that the more that we fielded out to other people to do, it would come back not in the way that I wanted it to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, or there'd be some breakdown in communication. Maybe I'm not a great communicator. It would come back wrong. So I felt the more that we can do and make ourselves, the more control we'll have over it.
Yeah.
And again, it's that punk DIY ethic. And also we can do things really quickly. You know, it's like if you want to publish a book, you go to a mainstream publisher. They say, well, we'll start the development now, and then maybe in 6 months we'll announce it. Then maybe in 2 years we'll actually publish the book.
Yeah.
So I want it done next week. Yeah. You know, we want to, and Billy's again like that, and all the artists were like, they just want to get on and do something and not sit around waiting. So.
Well, the attitude that you've got towards, or work ethic, however you may look at it, the three artists in L13, being Jimmy, Jamie and Billy, they've all got exactly the same outlook as you, haven't they?
Yeah, and I think it was because they were all on the margins of the mainstream. They were somehow better known for other things other than making art. Yeah. So at the time, Billy was much better known for it as a musician.
Yeah.
Jamie obviously was known for doing the Sex Pistols stuff. Yeah. Jimmy was known for being the KLF and burning £1 million.
Yeah.
So they all had these legacies, and they all wanted to have more attention paid to their, what they're doing now, but had have these... And also Billy had the whole thing of being Tracy Emin's ex,
yeah,
and that, and tied in with the Stuckists, which was a huge cloud which we had to somehow work through. They didn't want to be artists in the regular way. They didn't want to, you know, they hadn't gone to college, you know, done their MA, got their CV together, been studious, done all the you know, the brown nosing to get involved with the art world and curators. They were, they all come from this more, I suppose, more pop culture background.
Yeah.
That was faster moving. They had, they understood the nature of collaboration because they'd either been working in design or in bands or with bands. So there was always a shared ownership of the creation,
yeah,
process. That wasn't, you know, wasn't this, I'm an artist and it's, no, all about me.
Yeah. They was rebelling against the establishment that they are very strongly a part,
yeah,
of.
Yeah, and, you know, and also they, you know, just, you know, what great legacies to be part of. And now, yeah, I was, course, interested in anything to do with counterculture.
Well, at the time, I liked the idea that what it was going against, even though I loved what it was going against, I liked the idea that there was people, I mean, from my background, I love someone who's rebelling against something, even if it's something I adore, you know.
Yeah.
But I didn't realise, I must have seen it somewhere, but even when I was talking to Billy, all these years later, I didn't realise that he was in it for such a short time and was trying to get away from it, and he was sort of nigh on being dragged back to it.
Yeah, you know. And it's partly because of the way Charles Thompson ran Stuckists, that he's, you know, he's a bit of a, you know, monomaniac megalomaniac, and
yeah,
he's and you know, he was very keen on publicity, and he knew that Billy was really good for publicity,
yeah,
so he would constantly kind of drag Billy into things, and Billy likes the attention, so
it's a win-win or a lose-lose.
And you know, and Billy was involved in writing the manifesto, and
yeah,
and if you read the manifesto, it is really good. But he wouldn't do any of the protests, and you know, and didn't like any of the art any of the others
Brilliant.
Were making, and you know, and Billy can't be part of a group unless it's his group. So, and it was Charles Thompson's, you
yeah,
know, setup, and. And to go back to the idea of, you know, rebelling or being critical, back when I was at art college, and I suppose it was because of the nature of the music I was into as well, which was, you know, kind of, I suppose quite arty, but quite, you know, it was anti mainstream culture. It wasn't,
yeah,
it wasn't trying to be pop music. It wasn't trying to entertain. It was trying to do something different. It was trying to, you know, kind of ruffle a few,
yeah,
feathers,
yeah,
and stir things up. So going into art college, I really thought that was the job of the artist, was to be critical, not to join in, to question everything,
yeah,
and ruffle some feathers. And that's what I thought was the job of the artist, not to encourage the bastards, you know, it was,
yeah,
to,
yeah,
try and stop them. You know, the idea of mainstream culture was, you know, that was the enemy. I don't really care so much now. And I have worked out the only way that you can be involved in the art world is at best to be amoral. If you support it actively, you're immoral.
Yeah,
If you just can't be bothered anymore because you're 56 and you're just, you want to leave it to the younger ones, you know. So I just say, well, you know, I know that, you know, we sell paintings through some very large, powerful galleries, which sell to some very rich, large collections,
yeah, yeah,
around the world. And I know that some of the people buying that artwork aren't going to be the type of people I particularly like on a political or moral level. But it's, you know, it's redistribution of wealth,
of,
and you know, and it helps keeps things moving along.
Yeah.
And you know, as always, it helps me. It helps pay for me and Adam to have our playroom here at L13,
yeah,
to do what we like doing,
and justifying everything into my,
well,
view.
Exactly. And I think and the model of L13 and the aquarium, which are what we were called before, was always, you know, coming up with wanting to do things, and really it was like, how do we afford to do this?
Yeah.
And you know, and there is, you know, a lot of pragmatism to work out how you make money and what is sacred, what isn't for making money,
yeah,
and what you can turn your hand to make money.
Yeah.
And I think I've always been quite good at have been quite canny at saying, we can do this, this and this, and that will make money. So with Jamie Reid, we'd do exhibitions. We'd never make any money from his exhibitions. Yeah. He'd want to show his paintings and stuff that all people wanted from him were stuff relating to the punk aesthetic and to his political edge or particularly anything to do with the Sex Pistols. So we published prints which provided what they wanted, which would make money to enable us to fund the exhibition so he could show what he really wanted to do.
I mean, how strong does his imagery from the 70s have to be that it's still so fucking relevant?
I know,
50 years later.
Yeah, I mean, it's I think that whole punk period was such a pivotal moment in cultural history. Yeah. I think it was the last time the establishment were really scared about something a bunch of kids were doing. Yeah.
And they made that very very visual, didn't they?
And now they've learned, you know, the people in power have worked out that you don't fight that kind of thing now, you encourage it you own it as quick as possible, sell it back.
Well, that's like the rave culture, which was the next sort of punk thing that come from nowhere, come from the underground, resurfaced out of the gutter.
With hip-hop, you know, you start off with, you know, kind of Public Enemy and NWA, and then you've got bloody Vanilla Ice on Top of the Pops within 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, they've worked out that, and even in the time that I've been doing stuff with somebody like Jimmy, so like saying he got into trouble with the Royal Mail for misusing their copyright material.
Yeah.
And they came down quite heavy and, you know, with cease and desist. And even when I started with him, I've got a collection of cease and desist letters. And most of them have come via Jimmy.
If you ignore them, is it just like a game of chess? Would that, now it's your move? I'm not doing
anything. It's a lot of hot air. I mean, you could probably do a whole podcast just on the stories I could tell about meetings with the Royal Mail and just running circles around what they think is their material when it's not. So actually, to give the example, so when I started working with Jimmy, what he got in trouble with was using the Machin bust, which was the image, the actual bust that somebody made of the Queen that they then used on the postage stamps.
Yeah.
And Jimmy's first ones was of her, that bust, with wearing a gas mask.
Yeah.
And looking like a stamp. And they said, you can't do that. That's using our copyrighted material. And initially he said, okay, fine. And he agreed to never do anything similar again. That was part of the agreement. So when I started working, we said, well, let's see if we can find a way around it, a workaround. So we published some more stamps, and Jimmy found a bust in the British Library that looked very similar to the Machin bust, but was of Lady something or other.
Yeah.
But once you put the gas mask on, it looked pretty much the same.
Yeah, yeah.
So we did these, and then the Royal Mail got wind of it, sent us a 21-page letter. Not only are you using our copyrighted material, you're breaking your agreement not to do anything similar again. So we ended up going for a meeting at the Royal Mail with the head of intellectual property, their designers, and another lawyer, and we went there and we explained that, you know, well, it's not actually...
Who went there from your side?
Me and Jimmy.
Brilliant.
Just me and Jimmy.
I was hoping you were going to say
and,
that.
We said, but, you know, but, and we explained it's not actually the Machin bust. And they said, it doesn't matter. It looks too much like...
Yeah, that was their phrasing. Yeah. It was so widespread, wasn't it?
And said, okay, right. And then we said, well, okay, what would the parameters be? And said, if it didn't have perforations and it didn't look like a stamp. And they said, well, maybe. And so Jimmy said, look, what I'll do is I'll go away and I'll come up with some new designs. We'll come back and we'll see whether you'll allow these new designs. So we set up this other meeting. I went back and he came with a projector connected to his laptop, and he projected this stamp and it looked exactly the same as the last thing. And they went, no, you can't do that. And he said, okay. So if I remove the perforations, they would remove it. And the lawyers were kind of saying, well, maybe, because it's like that. But ultimately, it's still because of the gas mask. It looks like what you did before, so probably not. And then Jimmy removed the gas mask, and you could clearly see it wasn't the Queen.
Yeah.
And then he put the perforations back and said, now can we publish it? And they went, yes.
Brilliant.
And then, with a click of it, he put the gas mask back, and he said, now can we publish it? And they went, No. One of the post office, the Royal Mail team started giggling.
And they knew they'd lost.
And in the end, you know, we just went away and carried on what we were doing, and they just left. And actually, no, the last cease and desist letter was when there was a Royal Mail strike, and Jimmy did the scab stamps.
Yeah.
That we published, and again, it had the Machin, the silhouette. On that, and we said that we'd printed 30,000 of these stamps, and we'd sent them all through the Royal Mail system, including we sent loads to the Prime Minister and the head of the Royal Mail, and obviously they didn't like that, and they sent us a long letter saying, you know, kind of, you can't do, you know, stop this, and we just ignored that one,
and nothing came of that.
No. And then with Billy, I got a cease and desist from Penguin when we published a book of his poetry. It was all based on a D.H. Lawrence book of poems that was published by Penguin, and he wrote it to follow the same format. And then we thought it'd be great to actually make the Penguin book, so we did this, and it was part of an exhibition we did. And they wrote to us and said you can't do that, and we said, okay, well, it's part of this exhibition we're expanding. And they were actually really nice. I said, okay, as long as you just stamp it with, you know, kind of, this is not an official Penguin Penguin book. And at the end of the exhibition, can you destroy, can you send us the books to be destroyed? And we decided, well, we don't trust them to destroy the books. So we had held our own burning ceremony.
And a burning thing is so so like embedded with authority, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. So as L13, what we've always been quite good at is if we run into problems, what we do is we run with the problem.
Yeah.
And actually, we did it with a friend of ours, Michael Curran, who runs Tangerine Press, and he published a book of Billy's poetry, and. There was and he had them all printed, and when he got them back, there was a misprint on the cover. And Mark was a real perfectionist, and he was heartbroken. You know, it's you know, that's just a waste of 700 quid. I'm going to have to get them all redone. I think there was an error inside as well, so he's going to have to get the whole print run redone. And he, you know, he came to me crying, and I said, well, why don't you do something with the books to, you know, rather than destroy them. We'll do something with them, and we'll make the money back for you to pay for the print run. And he said, no, I can't do it. I can't look at the books. So I'll do it for you. So we made the special edition in a box with a little tale about Michael coming to me crying like a big hairy baby. and we made him the 900 quid or 700 quid he needed to do the print run again.
This is why we need L13 out there. It's fucking brilliant. It's beautiful.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Artists. You've got your artists around you, but a question that I ask each guest is, if there was 5 artists past and present, what would your ideal group show be?
Ooh. that's really difficult, because it really does come down to that I'm not that keen on art or artists.
As soon as you mentioned this earlier on, I thought, well, this question's going to be a hard
and
one
I would
to
have
answer.
To say it would be an L13 show. It'd be something that I put together of, you know, the artists I work with.
Yeah,
I think that'd be the best show ever.
But that would be
So
you and five others, and there's only you and four others.
Yeah, no, but there'd be me and Adam. But that's one, I suppose. Jamie, Jimmy, Billy. No, Jamie. Yeah. So that's four. And then Sophie, she does photographs under the name of Foxtrot Lightning and more political graphic workers. Sister, voila, of course.
Voila. And there is the answer, yeah. Voila.
And she's collaborated with Jamie on some posters and prints.
Superb. So even in your imaginary exhibition that you could have anywhere, you're excluding everyone from it, and
and I think it's just that thing of it is weird. I'm just, on the whole, I'm just not that interested in the wider art. I go to see art shows now. I take my daughter, who's 17, she's at art, just starting out at art college.
Nice.
And I like going to museums and exhibitions with her because she's not as jaded and cynical as me, and she gets a genuine. I can see the excitement. She's really interested.
You're looking from different eyes, yeah, thanks so, to her.
Yeah. Yeah, and likewise, I'd go to the cinema with her and atrocious films, but because I could, it was like seeing it through her eyes.
Does that allow you to step out of yourself for a moment?
Yeah,
and even enjoy things that you don't enjoy. Yeah.
And my girlfriend is a lot more of an art fan. You know, again, I can start appreciating stuff because she likes it.
Yeah.
And also, when me and Adam started painting as Harry Adams, we would make the... And in fact, around our birthday, rather than do an exhibition, we'd always have a field trip to go and see some shows. So we'd go... We'd end up mostly in the pub. End up really pissed by the end of it. But we'd go to somewhere like the National Gallery, and and I prefer the older stuff, and I like anything up to the modernist period.
Yeah.
After that, it all gets starts getting a bit jaded for me. But even with that, I'd go to the National Gallery or Tate Britain and be looking at all this stuff, and all I could see is just rooms and rooms of disappointment. And I thought, if I'm looking at my own work, I can see is how it's not really that good. And I thought, I'm looking at it, it's not really that good, is it? And actually, I've got a great story about my daughter when she was little. Now she's a little bit more open to art and culture and is interested in finding out more. But when we were little, we went on holiday to Oslo, and we went to the Munch Museum. And by this point, I was a little bit more engaged. And, because of Billy, I was interested in Munch. Yeah. And they had this exhibition of the Van Gogh paintings that Munch had been influenced by. Yeah. So they had the Van Gogh and Munch. And I thought, I've got to go and see it. It's just for Billy.
Yeah.
We went along and, it's like within 5 minutes, I was on about the second painting. My daughter, she's, I don't know, seven at the time. She said, Dad, can we go on board? I said, why don't you go and have a look at all the paintings and come back and tell me which one's your favourite? So I just keep her occupied. And she says, I've already seen them all. They're all rubbish. They're worse than your paintings.
And that's the, that's your critic's choice.
Yeah, yeah. Worse than your paintings.
Is that what you'd have on your gravestone, do you think?
Yeah, yeah. And actually, and what I discovered that, because I'm quite curious about artists like Munch, and I found going to the Munch Museum and looking what he did, the paintings that I liked best were his worst ones.
Okay.
Not the ones that everybody liked, the blockbuster ones. I like the ones which I thought, why did he do that?
But do you like them because they're not the best known ones?
Because I'm curious as to why, what it was that made him do that or leave it like that. I said, if you saw that in a skip and it wasn't Munch, Munch didn't exist, you'd think that can stay in the skip.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But because it's now in a museum and it's by Munch, it's got this lauded status, you think, what is it about this that, and I think, and I like the fact that it's making me question that.
Yeah, no, that's good.
And that's good. Whereas the stuff that everybody likes, it's a Munch, isn't it?
Is that because you're the artistic genius that you are?
I'm a natural born contrarian. Oh, no, it actually wasn't this year. It was last year. We had a family get together. Again, my daughter loves Rucanus. My dad's, had a, half bottle of wine and said, the thing with Steve is born awkward. Born awkward, he was.
But that's like, that's with the four of you, Harry Adams and the other three, that is as if you've got all of those awkward, annoying kids from every school, and they've made their own little gang.
And they're all
very like-minded people who are spending their time sort of just irritating the world outside them.
Perfect. And what do you think you'd like to do if you wasn't an artist?
When we'd moved to Farringdon Road, so it might have been about 2007, and I did an interview for some magazine, and they asked me what is your ambition as an artist, and I suppose I was a gallerist at the time. And I said to stop making art, and at the time I said, and have a pig farm. Since then I've worked out that I don't think I could go through with killing pigs. I consider myself a failed vegetarian.
Yeah.
When I was younger, I was vegetarian, but again, I think it was mostly to irritate my dad. But ideologically, I'm a vegetarian. I think human beings should have evolved out of, and it's not so much the killing of animals to survive, it's the factory farming and the industrialisation and the cruelty that's involved in that. And I wish that I didn't like meat so much and I could be vegetarian, but I don't. And originally I thought, well, I have a pig farm and I can, you know, raise pigs.
Yeah.
But I think I'd fallen in love with the pigs too much. So it'd become an ever-growing pig farm and I'd have to stop breeding them and then it'd become awkward. But now, that was in 2006. And I think I'm somebody who doesn't need art to be happier. I could be a builder, you know. And actually, another artist that I work with, Neil Jones, who's a very, very good painter. I did a couple of shows with him, published a book. He had a real love-hate relationship with the art world and felt compelled to make art, and he ended up working with another gallery and was very unhappy doing it. And I said, well, why didn't you just, you know, kind of stop making art for a bit? And he had this thing of... He had this thing of being the lone artist, and he worked by himself, and he struggled with himself making his art. And I just said, just, you know, do something else. And at the time, I'd made I called it a prison for my daughter's rabbits at the time, because we let them run free, but they just ate everything.
Of course.
So I made an enclosure, and of course, you know, being slightly creative, I made it quite nice. And I said that to me was as good as making a painting.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, and it doesn't really matter to me. If I'm cooking or making something, being creative, if I could make music, you know.
So it's the creative process that's part of you, not the end product,
if you like. And also, you know, and for me, the best thing about the creative process is the community of friends and artists or people that you end up working with.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was never very interested in the idea of a family unit. And I used to say when I was young and rebellious, I didn't choose my family. Yeah. I mean, I really like my family and, you know, I love them, you know, and I really love my parents now, but I had a huge problem with all of them for most of my adolescence. And so, you know, with the friends I made, I choose those. I did not choose my family. I did not choose to be raised in the way I was. I didn't, you know, and so this is all about me, you know, creating.
So you're still rebelling all these years.
Yeah,
later,
or I'm just trying to find the world that I'm comfortable in.
Yeah,
and I think, you know, through L13, I found the people I'm comfortable with and the activities that I'm comfortable with.
You found
with.
Your own family.
Yes,
like.
I have to pinch myself sometimes. I can't believe that I'm allowed to do what I'm doing. And of course, I would like more. I'm still looking for more pats on the head. So, you know, so if a gallery came along and said, "Well, Harry Adams, we're going to give you a major exhibition," I'd be more than happy. But otherwise, we'll just carry on doing what we're doing in the way that we're doing.
Of course, perfect. Waiting for that that cash cow to come.
And in the meantime, because we do all the not Banksy stuff, which makes a lot of money.
Well, that's what I was going to come to. Mm. I remember seeing the not Banksy and laughing, and the guy I was with wanted to get one because what if it is? And I said, well, that's the fucking point. And I said, it's pointed at people like you and people like me, and I want it for the opposite reason as you want it. You know, I want it because it's fooling people who think it might be. But then how do I know that it's not? Maybe I'm wrong, you know, maybe it is.
Yeah, and I think we've been doing it for so long now that I think if there was going to be a big reveal, it would have happened by now.
You've not had a cease and desist off of Banksy.
No, but I did have one email from Pest Control only a couple of years ago, and that was because some pieces had been turning up in auction in Europe, and people had bought them, had then sent them to pest control for all to be authenticated. Okay. And, you know, and we make it as clear as possible.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And that was part of the game. And we, it was, you know, we knew it, to begin with, we were being a bit cheeky, because we knew that the more we said it wasn't that vulnerable, the more they'd believe that it was. So, but as it time went on, we'd just make it really clear that, we're making them. It's really obvious. We're taking the piss and having a bit of fun, and also we're making pieces which are much better than Banksy. Yeah. So, you know,
well,
so
that's the trouble with Banksy being a myth. People perceive that myth to be.
Yeah, so, but anyway, so I got an email from Pest Control, and they're saying we'd got these things, and because they're being sold in to non-English speaking, even though to us it's clear that it says not Banksy and not by Banksy, they think, they think it, they'd not convinced. And I said, well, look, you know, what you can do is, like, we'll refund it. If, you know, they want their money back, we'll refund them. We'll buy the work back from them at whatever they paid it. And we'll work, you know, we'll try a little bit harder to make sure that the certificate, so now we stick the certificate on the back so they can't be separated.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we make it as clear as possible that they're, and, you know, and it's important to us that people know that we're the artists.
Yeah.
You know, it's
that has also gone through some name changes, and I wrote the name changes down just this morning, so that I knew there was half a dozen, and it turns out there's more than half a dozen. And can you remember the names that it started, or the progression?
Well, yeah, so it was not Banksy up until 2009, when we did actually stop, because we were finding a little bit tiresome that and we didn't want to be tricking people, and we felt that too many people were buying it for the wrong reason.
Yeah.
So we just stopped, and we didn't do anything for 10 years. And then because things were turning up in auction and going for more money, and also people were faking our stuff and saying they were by Harry Adams or by STOT 21st, and they were obviously not, because they were shit. And people were buying them thinking they were buying. This is mad.
What was they reselling at?
You know, anything from a few hundred quid to up to thousands.
So they're faking the fake.
Yeah. And so this is nuts, because anybody can be not Banksy.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, we'll start again. But we said that not Banksy was dead, so we can't be not Banksy. And that's how it's. So we'll be not Banksy. And that's quite good, because it's a double negative. And then we did an actual exhibition. Then we decided it'd be really good if not Banksy died on the eve of his first exhibition and couldn't do any more. And then so we did that. And then we thought, actually, it'd be really good if we could continue this, because we made quite a lot of money. And it's really good fun. So then we came back as the new Not Banksy Realisation. And then in between that, there'd been the Continuity Not Banksy. And then, oh my God, what's
the International Neo Not Banksy Artist Alliance?
Anatist Alliance.
Oh, was it? Sorry.
Yeah. So now Anatist is a coin, a term coined by Marcel Duchamp to describe his position as an anti-art artist.
Oh, okay.
So, and well, I quite, and of course, it's like perfect. Anarchist. And, and so we, and also I discovered there's a group that I can't find any reference to anywhere else. Other than there was a show about Russian Dada that I went to with my girlfriend in Madrid, and I bought the catalogue, and we nicked a whole load of text off one of their really dense wall texts for one of our catalogues, which is one of my favourite pieces of writing that we did around the Not Banksy story. But there was a group called the Nothingists in Russia. And the only reference I can find it is in this catalogue. So we are now neo-nothingist, anatist, artists, or not even artists. I love all of that.
And the last one that I read was the new Not Banksy Land of the Rising Sun.
That is for Japan. I think. And it's the...
So is it a splinter group?
It's become a splinter group, yes. Yeah. And we've actually got two exhibitions coming up in Japan this year, both in Japan. It's really weird the way they do, they have their gallery. The galleries seem to be part of, commercial galleries are part of department stores.
Oh, well, okay.
So we've got two Not Banksy exhibitions in department stores, one in Osaka at the end of June, and one in October in Tokyo.
Are you going to be out for those? Or
we're trying to work it out. We might actually go out and make some work, especially for them. But yeah, we started working with a gallery in Miyazaki, which is in the south. It's a small city in the south of the island, and it just started off him selling a few of our bits, and then we ended up doing stuff specially for, you know, commissioned for, and we really like the idea that there's stuff being produced in Japan that's, you know, because when we were kids, getting a Japanese import record was like really special.
So, and that's a whole different market.
Yes, yeah. Oh, actually, I'll tell you what was really funny is that he first contacted us asking if he could buy some Not Banksy, and said, because he owned some, and then he sent me the ones he owned and they were fakes.
Brilliant.
And I said, yeah, but those aren't actually by us. And then he ended up, you know, we have developed a bit of a relationship. And, and at the time, again, my daughter is a big influence in my life and everything I do. She was obsessed with Japan at the time and East Asia, and she's desperate to go there. So I said, look, I'll build up this relationship with this gallery in Japan, then that'll give us a good excuse to go to Japan at some point. So that was my main motivation.
Well, I've got saying that about fakes. I've got a friend called David Henty. He was a forger. He's now a copyist. And on the front of his house, he's got a blue plaque, and it said, David Henty painted more Lowry's than Lowry.
I've never had any problem with people copying. Actually, I had it when I was art college. You know, somebody noticed that somebody in the art college had done something very, very similar. And they actually took me and said, look, he's copying you. And I said, oh, that's great. You know, so he might have just had the similar shit idea.
Well, that was my attitude when I got told that a thing called the Empathy Museum were doing something exactly the same as a project that I'd been working on for several years. So I would ask an artist to send me a pair of their shoes along with a written piece of text about something they've had on their mind for years, something they've done wrong, something they've sort of kept away and it's been getting you down. Give it to me and I'll walk a mile in your shoes. Then I got told that this Empathy Museum were doing it. And I said to someone, look, I didn't invent walk a mile in your shoes, that phrase. I'm very aware that it's a common thing. They've probably just had the same idea. Yeah. And that was exactly my attitude. Just me being inquisitive, I went and looked at the Empathy Museum online. And it is this, it's a transient museum, you know, rather than a building. Mm. And I've looked at all the people involved, and there's curators and there's accountants, and, you know, as these big structures have, and then it goes up to trustees, and, you know. And then when I looked at the CEO, it turns out he's an author of books on empathy. Mm-hmm. And I saw him on TV 6 or 9 months previous. And when he was talking about empathy, that's when I had my sort of moment of going, that's the word that unites all of my work. So I contacted him and said, look, just seeing you on telly and hearing you speak, you know, it made me have this realisation. This is a project I'm doing at the moment and blah, blah, blah. Told him about this project. He tweeted the project. And I had loads of people I didn't know contacting me saying, oh, what a beautiful project. Mm. And like you're saying, I've got these little pats on the head and I felt, you know, I was sitting there wagging my tail. And then I hear about this project. And like I just said, I said, oh, it's not mine. When I saw that it was him, I was like, you fucking bastard. I told you the project and 9 months later, you're bringing it out. That's when I stopped being nice and inquisitive. Yeah. But I've still done nothing about it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what is there to do about it? And, you know, we get it, you know, people have done, you know, like Jimmy makes a riot and, riots and jam jars. And we see loads of people are now, you know, you see them all over, people doing little models of it. They're never as good as Jim is.
Of course.
And I think that's a bit, and people, look, he's copying Jimmy. And said, yeah, but that'd be like you telling Harry Adams that they're copying Van Gogh because they're using oil paints.
Yeah.
You know, a painting is a painting. And they're traditions that you can work within. And, you know, and just because, Van Gogh painted flowers doesn't mean we can't.
No.
You know, so it's all fair game as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
With the Not Banksy stuff, my only concern was they were rubbish. And people were spending good money buying them, thinking they were by us. You know, it's like not realising that there's no joke and there's no... What we love to do with the Not Banksy, there's always a backstory. There's always, a bit of a story to go with it.
Yeah.
There's always an inherent joke or piss take within the work.
Of course.
And, you know, and we try to weave some kind of nonsense around what we're doing.
Which a lot of the time, the guy I was with, they just installed in that they possibly could be, because they're trying to really make me look as though trying to make it look as though they aren't.
Yes, yeah.
Which made him want to buy one even more. And just lastly, anything coming up for yourself, L13? I know there's bucket loads before.
Yeah, yeah, and usually this time of year is more quiet. But we've got the reinvention of STOT 21st E Plan B, which you're now allowed to. I always would say you could have to say the full name, but people would always call us Stock 21.
Yeah.
And now we've decided that the 21st E Plan B bit is silent, and you can say Stock 21. So there's a Stock 21 new website and an exhibition called Revelations 1331. The Fish Island Prophecies Revealed is opening on Tuesday, the 13th of February, and running to the 13th of March at the Black Cube Gallery on Fish Island. And good luck to anybody who actually finds the Black Cube Gallery, because the entrance is very difficult to find. But yeah, you can find details of that on our website.
Perfect.
And other than that, Jim is working on a book which we'll publish later in the year. Billy's got an exhibition at the Carl Friedman Gallery later in the year, so he's painting for that. We'll probably be doing some prints at some point, and other projects. Very often we don't know what we're going to do next month. You know, some people say, what are your plans? And so, I don't know. But
something had come up.
By the time we get there, we usually have more than we can cope with.
Good.
So, but at the moment, we're heads down organising the Stock 21 show.
And is Jamie doing anything? Have you got anything?
I've got nothing currently lined up with Jamie, but we're always saying that we should do something again. So undoubtedly, we will at some point this year.
Perfect.
Do something.
And where can anyone find Harry Adams, L13, be it social media or website?
Well, if you Google L-13, you will probably find plenty. And if you add Light Industrial Workshop, you'll find even more. But the L-13.org is our website. And, of course, we've got Instagram, Facebook. I believe there's a Twitter account, although I never look at it.
I love that. I believe there's one.
Yeah. Soph is in charge of all that stuff.
Good. Well, that's all my questions done, and I have loved this conversation.
Oh, well, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Well, hope you enjoyed that episode of the Ministry of Arts podcast. So we wasn't dictated to by advertisers, we decided from the offset to go ad-free, which means, obviously, we had to self-fund. So we set up the Ministry of Arts Patreon page. And without that support, we would not be able to produce this podcast. So if you like what you hear and you're able to support the podcast, just go over to the Ministry of Arts Instagram profile. You'll find a Linktree drop-down box, which will direct you straight to our Patreon page. And for the price of a cup of coffee, you can help keep us growing week by week. But if you're not able to do that, that's fine, because this content is free for everyone. But leaving a review on whichever platform you listen to your podcast, that really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast. Or even giving us a positive shout out on your social media. Everything is appreciated. But either way, thanks for listening. And until next week, ta-da.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.